Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the choreographed Kim Trump photo op that was very light on substance and even lighter on the takeaway, a one-page signed agreement which promised much less than the 1994 and 2006 joint communiques, which has left almost all specialists on Korea and U.S. officials who have dealt with the peninsula considerably underwhelmed. Grace Liu, a research associate at the East Asian Nonproliferation Program at the Middlebury Institute for International Studies at Monterey, joins us to discuss what was left undone and glossed over, and that is some kind of nuclear arms reduction agreement with North Korea in exchange for vague security guarantees offered by Secretary of State Pompeo, who declined to describe what they might be. With no substantial action forthcoming on denuclearization, the Singapore summit was hardly a victory for disarmament. But now that the door is open for more meetings ahead, we will assess whether at the end of the day, the best deal that could be arrived at between the U.S. and North Korea might end up looking a lot like the Iran deal, which Trump tore up. Then we speak with Kyung-Hoon Hwang, who is a professor of history and East Asian languages and culture at the University of Southern California, who writes a biweekly column for the Korea Times of Seoul, whose most recent study is Rationalizing Korea. He joins us to discuss how the ego-driven amateur who talked of pristine North Korean beaches as real estate opportunities to build condos might just be the best person to pull off this deal, since clearly over the decades the professionals have failed. We will also look into the frightening signal that a desperately poor country devoting all of its resources to make nuclear weapons sends to the world. If you want respect and to be taken seriously, then get a nuke. Then finally, we will speak with the Canada Research Chair in Comparative Political Economy and Distinguished Research Professor of Political Science at York University, Leo Panitch, about President Trump's new best friend, the North Korean dictator he describes effusively as a talented man who loves his country very much. Compared to his newest global enemy, Canada's Prime Minister, who Trump refers to dismissively as Justin. We'll discuss how China reaches out to the world by building roads while Trump builds walls. And joining us now is Grace Liu, who's a research associate at the East Asia Nonproliferation Program at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey, where she focuses on East Asian missile and nuclear programs. She also serves as an intelligence analyst in the U.S. Army National Guard. Welcome to Background Briefing, Grace Liu.
Thank you, Ian.
And I stayed up quite late last night, I don't know whether you did, to see the sort of signing and then the press conference. And I must say that it did really feel mostly like a photo op, very little substance. There was just that one-page communique, and most analysts see it as being much thinner than the 1994 joint communique or the 2006. So if people were looking for nuclear disarmament, they got pretty thin pickings.
Right, exactly. So I think as many analysts have already noted, it was a great press opportunity from the flags aligned right next to each other to the very picturesque location that they chose. It was clearly much more for the press, as you said, than it was for any substantial agreement towards potential denuclearization. So one thing that was really missing, again, like from the previous agreed framework, is any type of technical or substantial way forward for any denuclearization process. So what we're lacking here is a timeline or any type of technical verifiable aspect where we can bring in experts and different officials who can say, yes, this amount of substantial progress has been made towards dismantlement or disarmament.
So the fact that the North Koreans let Sig Hecker in, the former head of the Los Alamos National Laboratory, to look at a lot of facilities, he's made, I think, about 8 trips. I'm not sure the total, but he has made a number of trips. Now, clearly they were designed to send a message to the West about what North Korea has. But could that be a model to build on? I know that was just one individual. You'd need, what, hundreds, if not thousands, of UN inspectors, would you not?
Right. So when we're talking about this buzzword that's been going around, CVID, which is complete, verifiable, irreversible dismantlement, we're talking about something that has to be done over a long process. And actually, Sig Hecker and one of his colleagues actually released a study recently that outlines a 15-year-long denuclearization plan. So we can see that from a technical side, in order to really verify that this denuclearization has happened, we have to have many experts and technical inspectors involved at every stage of the process to be able to be there in person and document everything that's going on. So that being said, I think having these opportunities where North Korea lets in a scientific expert such as Sig Hecker to go and view the facilities and the capabilities that they have serves two purposes. Like you said, it allows them to a reliable channel to communicate what capabilities that they do have. But then for us on the other side, it also opens up some channel of transparency between the two countries or two actors, or just between North Korea and the rest of the international community. And so to an extent, it is very beneficial for us, and it will continue to be beneficial for them to arrange more of such visits with high-level officials, more preferably, again, scientific experts or non-proliferation experts.
And again, I'm speaking with Grace Liu, who is a research associate at the East Asia Non-Proliferation Program at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey, where she focuses on East Asian missile and nuclear programs, and she also serves as an intelligence analyst in the U.S. Army National Guard. So for somebody that works in non-proliferation and denuclearization, Grace, do you share my concern that North Korea is sending a rather frightening signal that desperately poor countries devoting all of their resources to make nuclear weapons sends to the world, which is that if you want respect and to be taken seriously, then get a nuclear weapon?
So it certainly seems that way, and I think a lot of other analysts and experts in the non-proliferation field would agree, because it's been less than a year since North Korea successfully tested their first intercontinental ballistic missile. And in less than a year, Kim Jong-un was able to have a meeting, a high-level summit, a highly televised summit with the President of the United States. And so from a visibility standpoint, that does signal a very troubling pattern. I think what will really solidify how this summit is viewed is where North Korea-U.S. relations go from here. So from a disarmament perspective, of course, we'd love to see some type of further agreement that calls upon something like the agreed framework, where technical experts are brought in and we're able to negotiate the beginning steps of a disarmament agreement. However, if this doesn't happen and this just remains a photo op, a press opportunity, and it just seems that North Korea was able to organize this high-level meeting and gain this legitimacy from a bilateral summit meeting with the United States president, then I think that will really solidify that frightening message that, you know, if you're not an economically strong country, you don't have conventional military resources that can stand up to, I guess, these larger militaries in the world, that if you develop nuclear weapons, you can gain that legitimacy and earn a spot at the table with other high-level actors.
But surely you have to add to that the fact that President Trump's making a deal with the North Koreans and offering them this tremendous deal of respect as an equal player on the world stage, at the same time really turning the screws on Iran, who signed the P5+1 deal with the world powers, which he then tore up. So what is that? Where does that leave the Iranians? In other words, they look like suckers because they agreed to disarmament.
Right. So again, I think this will really depend on where U.S.-North Korean relations go from here. So I think if in the next few weeks or next few months the Trump administration does decide to negotiate a more technically verifiable disarmament agreement that is similar to the JCPOA, maybe that will soften the blow in a way so that maybe the Iranians will be more hopeful that the U.S. could either return to the JCPOA or that the U.S. is actually willing to renegotiate such a deal. But also in this international community, I think another actor who could be troubled by the upcoming relations between the U.S. and North Korea is South Korea. And we know that the Blue House is watching very closely at the summit yesterday to see what language would come out of this signed agreement and to see if the U.S. would, in a sense, leave South Korea in the dust and promise to withdraw troops or halt exercises in order to receive some concessions from North Korea.
Well, that's already happened, hasn't it? They were quite alarmed at Trump's remarks that the exercises were provocative and his hints that he might reduce U.S. troops on the peninsula. And also, what do you make of the vague security guarantees offered by Secretary of State Pompeo, who declined to describe what they might be?
So, again, with this administration, I think we really need to wait to see what actions come out of the words that were said. So right now, I think it would be safe to say that we won't see a substantial withdrawal of American troops from the peninsula. And if we see any scaling back of joint exercises, I'm not sure that the president would want to halt exercises altogether, as he's claimed, because that would signal a pretty strong de-escalation of joint U.S. and South Korea and, I guess, cooperation in their security situation. So I think what we can look forward to now is to see how these joint exercises may change, either in scope, in size, or in the type of missions that they're running in these operational exercises. And that may change to signal some de-escalation, but I don't think we'll be seeing any substantial withdrawal of troops.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, what about, since the South Koreans are a key component here along with the Chinese, and we've yet to hear from both, really, and obviously there'll be follow-on meetings, particularly with Putin and Kim and Xi Jinping and Kim, but what about the possibility of some kind? I don't think it was ever mentioned, at least maybe that it was and I missed it. What about some formal end to the Korean War?
So one of the interesting things that I noticed about the signed agreement from yesterday, from the summit yesterday, is the order of precedence that they put the four agreed points in. So I believe the first one was improving U.S.-North Korean relations. And then the second one right below that, even before any talk of denuclearization, was putting an end to the violence between North and South Korea. And so if that order of precedence has any significance, I think Trump and Kim could both benefit from another, maybe not bilateral this time, but multilateral signing of some document that formally ends the armistice and the war in general. So we'll see what form that an official ending of the war could take. I'm not sure if that would be a signed agreement per se, or maybe, I guess, an official declaration unilaterally or bilaterally from North or South Korea, and then maybe a commencement of something like the six-party talks that brings in not only North and South Korea and the U.S., but Japan, China, and Russia, and other actors in the region.
Well, the only thing that I find a little bit puzzling about this was this, if there is a formal end to the Korean War and it's announced and understood in the North, that's going to take away one of the biggest kind of bogeyman that they have, which is the Americans are about to go to war at any moment, and we're on a constant war footing. So that would really signal a change, would it not?
And I think we've already seen some of that change in rhetoric in the Rodong Shinmun and other North Korean newspapers and news outlets. We've seen less of the antagonizing the Americans and the South Koreans, and more, at least more press coverage in terms of pictures and stories about Kim becoming a more international leader and becoming more involved with other leaders and states and forming these good relationships. And these stories are resounding within North Korea, as far as we know. So we're already beginning to see sort of a shift in the type of regime that Kim is building and the perspective that is being built to portray South Koreans, Americans, and leaders of other countries.
Well, Grace Liu, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Cool. Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Grace Liu, who is a research associate at the East Asia Nonproliferation Program at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey, where she focuses on East Asian missile and nuclear programs. And she also serves as an intelligence analyst in the U.S. Army National Guard. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how this ego-driven amateur who talked to pristine North Korean beaches as real estate opportunities to build condos might just be the best person to pull off this deal.